Welcome to Smart Talk. I'm Scott Lamar. 13 drug overdose deaths in a span of 10 days. That's what happened in York County through last Tuesday. Even by today's standards, as Pennsylvania and the nation are in the midst of an opioid crisis, that many OD deaths in such a short period of time is alarming. So what's behind the rash of overdoses, and is it a sign of things to come? York County Coroner Pam Gay is one of the leading voices in the fight against opioids. York County Coroner Pam Gay is our guest today. Pam, welcome to the program.
Thank you. It's good to be here.
If you have a question or a comment, give us a call, 1-800-729-7532, or send an email to smarttalk@witf.org. 10 deaths in 13 days ending last Tuesday. Have there been any overdose deaths since then, Pam?
Yes. Unfortunately, we have had two more since that period, but it did obviously slow down a little bit, which is what we were hoping, unfortunately, we have had two additional since then. So.
Was that over the weekend or sometime after Tuesday?
We had one over the weekend and one last week.
So the reason I ask that question is I wonder whether, I don't know, I have nothing to base this on whatsoever other than people partying more on weekends. But when it comes to opioids and heroin, that probably doesn't come under the heading of partying. Just wondered if you had more overdoses around weekends or does it discriminate what time of the week?
I would say long ago we might have seen more over the weekend, but over the last couple of years, this happens every day of the week, pretty much every hour of the day. Because it's a disease and they have to use every couple hours, that's I think why you're not going to just see it over the weekend. Yeah, we see it 24/7.
The 10 deaths in 13 days, that is a large number over a short period of time. Do you know why there was that rash of deaths?
We won't know for a couple more weeks. We autopsy all our heroin fentanyl-related deaths, as many know. And along with that autopsy comes the toxicology. That toxicology won't be back probably for close to 2 months from the time of death, as far as till the final report is done. And we'll know better then. We'll have an idea if there was a particular type of fentanyl involved, which is sort of what we suspect. And that's what we've seen in the past. There have been maybe periods where there have been a more potent type of fentanyl or designer fentanyl that when we see maybe an increase in deaths. But it's almost always some sort of fentanyl.
Why do you suspect fentanyl?
Just because that's what we're seeing in almost all our heroin-related deaths now. We do have some that just have heroin, but fentanyl is what we're seeing more frequently. It seems to be why people are not responding as well to the Narcan or the Naloxone, or why it takes more doses of that. Sometimes they're found deceased because, they've been dead for a little while. It's just that potent that quite often they can't be helped as easily or reversed as easily. And if they do, they suffer what they call an anoxic brain injury. And they, are in the hospital and the family withdraws life support over a few days. So we're seeing that in almost all of our overdose deaths now related to heroin.
It's probably a good idea for those who aren't familiar to remind them what fentanyl is. What is it?
Well, it's actually a drug that's been around for a long time, also used in the hospital. This is not hospital-controlled fentanyl. Some people get it in patch form, for chronic pain. But this is not the patches. This is actually basically pills that are crushed or mixed in with the heroin, and then sometimes it's actually just processed as a designer type drug in clandestine labs and mixed in with the heroin, which is what we're seeing more and more. We believe that it's a designer analog of fentanyl that. It's maybe a little bit weaker than the original drug, but still does its danger because it's basically about 50 to 100 times stronger than morphine.
When you say a little bit weaker than the original, meaning what was on the street, the fentanyl that was being used in the past?
Yeah, I would say I'm not an expert, but that's what we're hearing is that the designer fentanyls can be just a little bit weaker because that's how it's more cost-effective to them, if that makes sense, or they mix, you know, thin it out, or, you know, I'm not a toxicologist, so I don't, you know all the details, but that's what we're hearing. So it's, you know, we get people all the time that ask us, well, isn't that costly to be mixing fentanyl in? But you got to remember, this is not hospital fentanyl. This is street fentanyl. And so it's not as costly for them to produce it.
So I have to admit that the first thought that went through my mind when you mentioned that the fentanyl was a little bit weaker is that maybe those who were making it were doing so because it was killing their customers. I guess that has nothing to do with it, huh?
I'm not sure. I don't know if they have that much compassion and care about their customers, although I do know that they, you know, probably want them to be coming back.
Well, yeah, I didn't think compassion care was part of it.
But you know, when I say weaker, I don't mean that it's not still potent. It is. This is deadly. This is so much stronger than anything that we've been seeing. You know, for the last, I would say the last 2 years especially, we're seeing fentanyl in a large majority of our heroin-related deaths. So this is really deadly.
Where's it coming from?
I'm not an expert in that regard. You're going to have to ask our DA. But I'm hearing that obviously the bigger cities around us, originally from Mexico, a lot of it. You know, I'm because I'm not involved in that end of it, the trafficking end of it, you're going to have to ask other experts, law enforcement, DA.
I thought you may be up on that because you are part of the task force in your county, the drug task force. Getting back to the OD deaths, and not just the 13 in 10 days, or no, was it 10 and 13 or the other way around?
It was 13 in 10 days.
That's what I thought. That's right. That's what I thought. Getting back, whether, and again, you may need the toxicology on this, but were there other opioids, the possibility of other opioids like painkillers that were taken orally?
We won't know that till the toxicology comes back, but quite often there are, but sometimes there are not. You know, so we see it both ways. We have some individuals who are on other painkillers, but we see a lot of individuals who are just ODing on the heroin and fentanyl.
By the way, I mean, and this goes back in the history of the past 3 or 4 years that, you know, we've heard many times that there are those who start with opioids, painkillers for a backache or teeth problem, you know, something like that, that once they can't get those opioids over the counter through a prescription anymore, sometimes they turn to heroin. And one of the reasons we have heard that it became so widespread is that the cost of heroin was so cheap. Do you have any idea, and I'm assuming you would just hear this through the grapevine and talking to your colleagues, but what heroin goes for on the streets of your county today?
We've been told about $5 a bag can go up, I guess, a little bit. I've been told that in York it's actually a little more pricey than in Baltimore, which is $2 to $3 a bag, at least that's what we're told. So, so it's still less costly than the opioid drugs themselves, which are about $1 a milligram. So it could take you, you know, 3 or 4 pills to give you the same effect as a bag or two of heroin. And so that could be very costly, 50 milligrams a pill. So
$5 a bag, but $2 to $3 on the streets of Baltimore.
That's what we've been told. It's more costly in York, yeah.
Oh, that's incredible.
I don't really know why, but...
Yeah. Well, it's all supply and demand, probably, but our guest during this portion of the program is York County Coroner Pam Gay. We're talking about a rash of overdose deaths in York County that it was over a 10-day period that ended last Tuesday, 13 overdose deaths during that period. We're talking about the opioid crisis overall. 1-800-729-7532 is the number to call if you have a question or a comment, or you can send an email to smarttalk@witf.org. That's 1-800-729-7532. So, Pam Gay, as far as the number of overdose deaths in York County this year, where do you stand right now? And again, I know you're still waiting for some toxicology reports, but what do you suspect?
Well, we have, so far this year, among our heroin and fentanyl, we're seeing 18 suspected and another 9 that have come back confirmed. So we're about 27, you know, give or take of one or two if some of those come back with something else instead. That's very similar to what we were about this time last year. We were actually a little bit higher by the end of March. We were close to 40, I believe. You know, obviously we have periods with this epidemic where the drug overdoses tend to increase a little bit, and then they'll slack off, and then we'll have more that will increase again. So we've had, on average throughout the year, two or three periods last year where they did increase for a while, and we put out similar warnings like we did this last weekend.
So you say that we're actually down. York County is actually down compared to this time last year.
Yeah, I really hesitate to say that because obviously – that could change overnight. So
yeah, but well, see, the next question I was going to ask is: say it's comparable. If, you know, not one death is not a good thing, but is it reason for optimism that you're comparable to last year, meaning that we may not see the kind of increase that we have in previous years?
I would say always reason for optimism. However, I also am realistic, and I would say that we've had, like I said, periods where it slowed down in the past and then it picks up. You got to remember, for the year of the entire year of 2017, we had 137 total heroin and fentanyl overdoses, our worst year yet, with another two that we're still waiting on that'll probably come back positive. So our drug overdoses for 2017 exceeded all other years prior for heroin and fentanyl. And I don't anticipate that this year is going to be much different. I really don't. I'm hoping it would be, but we've been told that the drug deaths will probably continue to be steadily in the numbers that we're seeing for a while. And I think part of that is our prevention efforts are, we believe, paying off, but we're not going to see results from those prevention efforts for a couple years till the kids that we've reached with those prevention efforts aren't at the age that these individuals are that are dying. And when those young adults get to the point that have had that prevention education, then hopefully they won't be picking this drug up and dying of it. We won't see those results for a few years. The people that are dying are the people that we can't reach with that prevention message because they've already started the addiction. And so the only thing that we can do for them is to try and talk them into going into treatment, save their lives, talk them into going into treatment, and improve access to treatment.
When you say these kids who are dying today, what I'm not going to ask the average age, but is there a range of age that you're seeing that are overdosing?
And I say kids, and a lot of times, I was talking about the kids that we're doing the prevention with, but the people that are dying are young adults. They're in their 20s to 40s, we're actually losing two generations now, because we're not just losing 20s to 40-year-olds, we're losing 40 to 60-year-olds also, who are picking up this addiction because they have already become addicted to opioid pills. And so they are crossing over to heroin more and more. So we are seeing a group of 40 to 60-year-olds, not quite as many as in the 20 to 40 range, but we're seeing more and more of those.
Is that new?
Over the last year and a half, we've been seeing that trend.
Mm. You're listening to Smart Talk on WITF, your home for NPR News and all things regional. I'm Scott Lamar. To learn more about the opioid crisis, plus a deeper look at the changing tide of healthcare, check out WITF's Transforming Health. From policy to personal choices, we're taking a comprehensive look at today's health system. Online at transforminghealth.org, a partnership of WITF, Penn State Health, and WellSpan Health. Our guest during this portion of the program is York County Coroner Pam Gay. She's been one of the most outspoken people during the opioid crisis, bringing attention to just how bad the situation is over the last few years. We're talking about a 10-day period when 13 people died from overdoses in York County that ended last Tuesday. If you have a question or a comment about the opioid crisis, what's going on in York County, and of course, this is not just contained in York County. This is throughout Pennsylvania, throughout our listening area, throughout the country, really. Give us a call, 1-800-729-7532. Send an email to smarttalk@witf.org. You can leave a question or a comment on WITF's Facebook page. On Twitter, we are at SmartTalkWITF. Again, that phone number, 1-800-729-7532. You touched on this, Pam Gay, a few minutes ago, but I wanted to kind of revisit it a little bit. You have been quoted as saying, and I think you've actually said it on this program before, that this situation may get worse before it gets better. What are the trends right now? And you say that from what you're hearing, a lot of this has to be based on what you hear on the street, what you hear from your colleagues in law enforcement. But do you stick by that quote that it could get worse before it gets better?
I would say that I agree with that still to this day. Like I told you, I'm optimistic that our numbers will be less by the end of the year. I have no reason to think that that's necessarily going to happen. I'm not going to be surprised if it doesn't happen, sadly, because our overdoses over the last year have increased so drastically that we may see that for another year or two or three before we start to see it decrease. And like I said, a lot of it has to do with the fact of the individuals who are dying are not the ones who are getting the prevention message. They're almost too late for that prevention message. All we can do is really reach them with improved access to treatment and hopefully save their lives and talk them into going into treatment.
Do you know how many people in your county have been saved by naloxone? And this is a drug, just for background purposes, that actually
they
can...
They just told us, I knew you were going to ask me that. They just told us at one of our meetings I know last year was in the 260 range, but I don't have the current numbers. You could ask York Adams Drug and Alcohol that. They have those numbers now. They're tracking those. Used to be law enforcement was tracking those, but or the York Opioid Collaborative, Dr. Matt Howey, they would have that information. But last year it was in the 260-some range of reversals.
So that's a lot of people. I mean, before naloxone, you possibly could add those 260 to the 137 that you had last year that actually did die. And I've heard of some people...
Some of them are repeats, though. You have to remember.
Well, that's what I was about to ask, that we've heard of some people overdosing and being brought back with naloxone multiple times. Are there some people who are relying on naloxone to save their lives?
I don't really think so. I know that that seems what people seem to think, but most heroin addicts or users are not walking around with naloxone in their pockets. Now, some of them have, obviously friends or family members that carry that, but they can't give it to themselves. So they have to, be around somebody that has it. I know there's this concept that people might be using more because naloxone is available. I truly believe that individual doesn't understand how this disease works because that is not the typical, I'm not saying that there aren't very few that might do that, use because they know somebody has some, but that is not the typical mindset of a heroin fentanyl user. They are using just to keep from being sick. They are using to stay well so that they can function. Many of them are functioning every day. They work jobs all around us. Definitely not using just because they know naloxone's around.
But are there families? We know that families where the parents or maybe the brothers and sisters know that someone in the family is addicted to opioids. They have been advised to keep some naloxone on hand. Do we know whether that's happening?
We tell them that all the time. We believe more and more families are doing that, although there are still a lot that don't because obviously when we get called to scenes sometimes where there's been a death, that will be something that's told to us by the family is I just didn't have any naloxone, I feel terrible. So we are really trying to get that message out, both us and York Opioid Collaborative and, Not One More who works with us are definitely trying to get that message out that if you don't have naloxone, let us know. There's places where you can get free naloxone. You can get it over the counter. Any pharmacy has a standing order that you can go in and get it. You don't have to even be seen by a physician anymore. So we're really trying to get that message out that if you have a loved one, even a loved one who's on opioid pills, for instance, even an elderly loved one who is using that for their chronic pain, you should equip yourself with naloxone because sometimes they mix their pills up and sometimes they forget when they last took them. And we have, you know, I'm a former nurse in the hospital, still a nurse, but I was a former hospital nurse, and we used to have elderly folks come in all the time who accidentally overdosed.
You know, heroin and fentanyl, to a lesser degree, gets all the attention with reviving patients through naloxone. But does naloxone actually work on those who have overdosed from opioid pills?
Yes, it's the same concept. So if they're on oxys, hydrocodones, those kind of things, it's the same type of drug, and they will be reversed with naloxone if it's available. So, yeah, it's good on a lot of narcotics. So,
you know, this is how the world has.
It's on every crash cart.
This is how the world has changed. You were talking about families obtaining naloxone. Saw a story in the York Daily Record just today about a nurse who was off duty who revived someone Thursday night in New York County, someone who was overdosing, and she recognized it, had some naloxone in her purse, and revived that person.
Yes, we even had an off-duty deputy coroner revive somebody 2 weeks ago. So it's pretty amazing. We carry naloxone in our office here. Every coroner, deputy coroner carries it. Which, you know, some people think that's a little bizarre being a coroner because aren't they already dead when you get there? But part of the reason we do that is so that we can help each other, law enforcement ourselves, if we would start to go down from exposure. And this individual, like this nurse, was off duty, and he heard the call come in, and he ran over with his kit and helped save somebody. So anybody can do this, and I give kudos to those individuals who go above and beyond, like this nurse and our deputy coroner, who go above and beyond and try to save lives. And, of course, law enforcement and fire and EMS who do it every day.
You know, I talk about how the world has changed. Just a few years ago, one of the challenges that we were facing in Pennsylvania is that not all coroners were reporting overdose the same way. So it was difficult for the state to get a handle on how many people actually were dying from overdoses. Has that situation changed at all?
Well, you know, I kind of get a little frustrated with that terminology or that description of not all coroners counting the same way. Since I've been here in 2014, all coroners have been counting them the same way. So I don't know what happened before, but I will tell you that, you know, at least since I've been a coroner since 2014, we're all counting them the same way. So I've not seen a problem with that since I've been coroner. So.
I guess what people pointed out before is that not all coroners were being specific with whether this was a heroin death, a fentanyl death, an oxycodone death, or, you know, from some other drug.
There's a criteria that we have to follow. We cannot put on the death certificate if there's a mixed substance toxicity. Many of us, you could break down into 10, 15 drugs. Some coroners and MEs do, medical examiners do. But there is, first of all, there's not enough room on death certificate to put all these drugs down sometimes. And it's also placing judgment as to which drug caused the death. And sometimes that can be a little tricky if you're narrowing it down and you're just picking. So we have to agree with what our forensic pathologist tells us came out in their results. And if it's a mixed substance toxicity, sometimes we'll write that down. But what we're doing in this office and what many coroners do, even if it's a mixed substance toxicity, we're putting it into a category if there's heroin and fentanyl involved so that we know that that involved heroin and fentanyl. So that when I'm giving you those numbers right now that I gave you for 2017, a lot of those were mixed drug toxicities that I just told you out of that 137. However, if they had heroin and fentanyl in their system, I am including that in that 137. So I think in that regard we're being more specific. But the way the forensic pathologist comes out with the cause of death, we have to be very careful that we follow that terminology because of the way it stands, you know, holds up in court. If we write something different, it won't hold up in court, and it shows a discrepancy. So I think the CDC and the coroners and MEs are trying to work out some things here with getting more explicit about all the drugs that are involved in somebody's death, but there is not enough room on that death certificate at this point. But we are sending all that data to various agencies, state and local agencies, and they're getting that breakdown. So that breakdown's out there. It's just not out there necessary for the general public, and we're already categorizing them into heroin and fentanyl, even if it's a mixed drug toxicity. So
I hate to ask.
It's definitely improving.
I hate to ask this question, but do the death certificates need to be larger or more space for that?
Well, now they're electronic. York County's been electronic for 2 years. Some coroners and ME's are still in the paper system, but the goal is to eventually go totally electronic. But we don't have, first of all, like I said, it has to agree with what our pathologist writes. So there needs to be some, maybe there needs to be some change or at least a look at that. And if it doesn't agree with what the forensic pathologist writes, and then it can cause a problem in court. Like I said, we get that data out to other individuals that need it, the various departments at the state level, the Department of Health. So it's not like we're hiding that information. And so we kind of get a little frustrated when people say that, we're, not doing it the way they think we should be doing it, because it's all getting out there. It's just not necessarily getting out exactly on the death certificate. It'll say mixed substance toxicity, because if that's what the forensic pathologist writes, that's what many of us write. There's definitely more court. There's less chance of it being a discrepancy for court purposes.
I don't know if there was criticisms of coroners overall. It was just that some offices, and if I can remember correctly, I mean, obviously yours was one of the ones that was right on top of this, that was providing better information than some others, maybe in some of rural counties that don't have the kind of resources that, say a York County does.
Believe it or not, there's coroner offices that don't even have, computers, believe it or not. And some of them are operating out of their homes, and they're very part-time. They don't have near the budget that we do. So you can have from one extreme to another. But I do think, all in all, our reporting system has, really improved, and I think, my colleagues are doing a great job.
Has your budget increased because of this? Because you're investigating so many more deaths?
Yes, unfortunately, we've had to increase our budget. So
by how
we've
much?
We've had to hire more people. We've had to increase, probably since 2014, we've increased in the $600,000, $700,000 range. So.
And that's due almost entirely to the opioid crisis?
I would say not entirely to the opioid crisis. My office could have used the budget increase long before I came, let's just put it that way. We got busier, incredibly busier. Our caseload has increased drastically because of this opioid crisis, but also just in general. People are aging and living longer, and definitely our population is growing in York. So we have gotten busier all in all, but definitely had to get our budget up to speed, because we are seeking national accreditation. A lot of my coroner's offices around me are accredited nationally. York is not. To do that, we have to improve some things around here when it came to staffing. And, we had deputies that were working 7 days straight before they got, they had one day off in between. We've gone to shifts so that we get a mental break and emotional break. When you're going from drug overdose to drug overdose to suicide, which is those are our leading causes of death here in York County, to suicide after suicide, all those things take a toll on a person. And so we had to get to the point where we were meeting more of the national standards. And so that's why we've increased our budget, as well as the opioid crisis.
That's something that we don't hear about very often with coroners or deputy coroners or medical examiners, that there's an emotional toll. I mean, a lot of people think that because you have chosen this line of work, that it doesn't have an impact on you emotionally, but it does?
It does, definitely. Since we've gone to 8-hour, 10-hour shifts, 8-hour basically most of the time, we have noticed an improvement in a lot of our mental and emotional well-being, our physical health even, just because we are getting a break from it once in a while. It's just made a tremendous difference. You get caught up in what you're doing, and you get You know, our work is with the surviving family members, and that can be very difficult and emotional. And we work with them for a long period of time. These cases, sometimes if they go to court, are going to last 2 to 3 years. So we're with that family from day one. We're checking in on them. We have volunteers that work with them that we've trained, and they check in with them, see how they're doing. We connect them with the entity, Not One More, so that they're a support to them. So definitely it can take a toll.
Are there days, nights, when you go home and say, this is unbelievable, I don't know how much more I can handle?
I don't think how much more I can handle, if that makes sense.
Maybe that was a poor choice of words. Yeah.
I think more like, how much more can our community handle? How much more can our families handle? And how much more can my deputies handle? Obviously, I worry, I kind of review all the cases. I don't go to every drug overdose. I go to some, but, they're at those scenes a lot more than I am because of my administrative duties. But I also get caught up with the families on the phone a lot. Sometimes they come in here for family meetings. So, yes, when you have a couple of family meetings, it can be very draining and emotional. But I always say to myself, it's nothing compared to what they're going through. And so that kind of helps me. Plus, we get families who inspire us all the time, every day, who are doing something and turning their tragedy into something positive and raising awareness. Just the founders of Not One More are a perfect example. They inspire us every day, those individuals that do that. And that's what helps us go on.
Let's take a call from Norman in Lancaster. Norman, you're on the air.
Thanks for taking my phone call. Kind of, I guess, a terminology question. What is the difference? Sometimes when you read the newspaper, you'll read coroner's reports, and it'll say accidental death. Are accidental deaths sometimes suicided, but they're listed as accidental death, or is a accidental overdose? How do you delineate between accidental overdose or overdose, which is basically, in a sense, done on purpose and would be probably termed a suicide?
Norman, thanks for your call. Good question.
Yeah, that's a great question. Yeah, we definitely, most of these drug overdoses, that 137 that I gave you, that number for 2017, and the ones that I just gave for 2018, those are considered accidental. That does not include suicide overdoses. Now, I will tell you that we have had a few suicides by heroin fentanyl, but it's very rare. And we kind of look at what they're doing. Are they going about their normal activities? Are they making plans for the next day? Are they leaving notes that says, hey, I want to end my life? So we kind of take all that into consideration. We have training that, obviously that we've been taught. And with the pill overdoses, we look for extremely large amounts in pill fragments on autopsy, that kind of thing. Those would be considered suicides. But in most of these heroin fentanyl overdoses, they were going about their normal activities. They were, making plans for the next day. They were not intending to end their life. Do they sometimes hate their life? Yes. Is their life miserable because they're so dependent on this drug? Yes. But many of them are accidental, the majority. So the numbers that we're giving are considered accidental.
Mm. Pam Gay, your county coroner. Hopefully the news gets better soon. But thank you very much for your hard work on this issue, and thanks for being with us today.
Sure. Thanks for having me. Thanks again, Scott, for raising awareness.
You're listening to Smart Talk on WITF, your home for NPR News and all things regional. I'm Scott Lamar. Welcome back to Smart Talk. One of the promises Donald Trump made when he ran for president was to end the war on coal that he claimed the Obama administration had undertaken. In 2017, between 700 and 1,000 new coal mining jobs were created, and coal production was up almost 2%. The administration cites the rollback of a half dozen regulations for the increased numbers. At least two mines opened in Pennsylvania last year, but word came recently about the shutdown of a four west mine in Greene County near West Virginia. The Allegheny Front's Reed Frazier reported on this story for State Impact Pennsylvania and joins us today. Reed Frazier, thanks for joining us today.
Thank
Thanks for having me.
If you have a question or a comment about coal production, coal jobs, give us a call, 1-800-729-7532. Send an email to smarttalk@witf.org. On Twitter, we are at smarttalkwitf. Again, the phone number, 1-800-729-7532. Read the Four West Mine in Greene County closing. Why is it being shut down?
Well, there's a lot of reasons. The mine is in a fairly somewhat thinner coal seam than the coal seam that the rest of the mines in this region usually work. They've been getting a little less every year out of this coal seam. They've been having problems, you know, kind of keeping the structural integrity of the mine. And just the whole net effect of all these factors is that they're getting less, you know, it's just a less efficient mine. For every hour somebody works there, they're just getting less and less coal out of it. So the owners of the mine decided it was no longer profitable and are shutting down. That's the proximal cause, I would say.
I want to talk about how much coal is being produced in just a moment, but something you just said, structural integrity, that sounds frightening.
Yeah, I guess they've had problems just because of the geology in that particular part of the coal seam, of keeping the ceiling of the coal mine in, and it's just become expensive to, you know, keep it safe. Now, two miners have lost their life in this mine in the last few years. One of them, a rock fell out of a wall. The other was not related to you know, rockfall of any kind, but it's definitely, you know, incredibly important in underground coal mining to have this kind of safety.
You know, one of the things that amazes me is the mindset of a coal miner. Even though, you know, we know it's very dangerous, there are 370 miners employed at this mine, Four West Mine in Greene County, but yet the people you talk to, I mean, obviously they're upset about losing their jobs, but they have no hesitation about going back into that mine, even though it sounds like it's dangerous.
Yeah, and I think it's a little hard for people who aren't sort of, you know, used to this, I guess, way of life, maybe it is a good way to put it, to kind of wrap their brain around. But, I mean, it's for a lot of these folks, it's, you know, it's not just something they do, it's something that their fathers or grandfathers did, and so it's, you know, not to sound cliche, but it is like a way of life. It is a sort of culture that you're kind of brought up in, and you know, there's incredible camaraderie that I've witnessed between folks who work in the same mine, and you know, it's good pay.
Yeah.
It's good.
Yeah, let's talk about it. You focused on a 19-year-old coal miner. He's been working in this mine for about 8 months. He was making almost $29 an hour. Now, my guess is there aren't many jobs in Greene County that pay 19-year-olds almost $60,000 a year. Would I be accurate in saying that?
Absolutely. And I mean, I think this is kind of the main, you know, one of the big selling points for keeping the coal industry around in places like Greene County is, look, that, you know, nobody wants their 19-year-old son to have to work at McDonald's or, you know, get an $11 an hour job with no benefits part-time. You know, that's increasingly what is available to folks who don't have a, you know, college degree or post-high school degree. And, you know, this isn't the first young man I've talked to who's gone right into the mines and you know, been making serious big boy money, you know, sort of. So it's, you know, it's just like, it, you know, for him, he really, the young man I talked to was really, you know, he wanted to go back. He wanted to keep coal mining at that mine. And he's going to be looking to go back into another mine once his job is done.
Well, as I mentioned, 370, as you reported, will be losing their jobs. What will those 370 people do?
I talked to a few of them, and a lot of them seem, you know, I was wondering if they're, you know, are they worried? Are they going to get another job in coal mining if they want it? And a lot of them seemed pretty, you know, confident that they could get work in coal mining. Now, I think the caveat is sometimes these guys have to go work as contractors in mines, which doesn't pay as well as being, you know, sort of attached to the mine full time. So, you know, there's a sort of a downgrade in pay sometimes, or they may have to commute to, you know, a different part of the state or, you know, down into West Virginia. So, you know, I don't think anybody really wants to have to find another job, but I, you know, in their minds, they think that they have, you know, a marketable skill and can get rehired somewhere. So.
But yet there have been stories of coal miners who have retraining available to them that they're not taking advantage of. Is it accurate that that's happening?
I think it is. You know, and I think it kind of goes back to some of the things we've been talking about, where it's seen as, you know, mining coal in Greene County, you can top out at around $30, $33, $35 an hour. You can make overtime. You can make into six figures. If you retrain into something else, I mean, some people have, you know, gotten out of coal because they, you know, it's too cyclical. There's too many layoffs. It's dangerous, et cetera, et cetera.
Plus the fact that there's less reliance on coal today.
Yeah, and the long-term trend is not good for coal, that's for sure. So, but, you know, it is one of these things where as long as the mines are still running and they're still paying good, you know, they're going to find people who want to stay down there.
What about the Trump effect, though? I mean, we know when Donald Trump ran for president in 2016, he campaigned several times in southwestern Pennsylvania, West Virginia, talking about ending the war on coal. Are there miners who believe that coal is going to make a comeback with Trump in the White House?
Yeah, that's a good question. I think the way I would answer that is this, and a lot of people have been wondering, you know, what do you think now? Is coal coming back? Is he going to bring back coal? And I don't think a lot of these folks believe that it's going to go back to what it was 5 years ago. Like, just to give you some numbers, 5 years ago, 6 years ago, there were about 8,000 miners in Pennsylvania. Now there are probably close to 5,000. Maybe even fewer because of this mine shutting down. So there's been a big drop off in coal mining jobs, not just in Pennsylvania, but around the country. But the miners who are still in the business think that they're better off with Trump in the office, getting rid of more regulations for coal and just kind of holding this status quo, this, you know, sort of 5,000 miners in Pennsylvania level than with a Democrat or with Hillary Clinton in the House. So do they think it's going to come back? I haven't talked to too many people who think that it's going to come back to what it was a few years ago, but I think a lot of them wanted to just hang on at current levels for however long it can.
I mentioned in my introduction that there was a 2% increase in coal production in the United States last year, and actually between 700 and 1,000 new jobs in the coal mining industry added across the country. Now, again, we're talking about one where 370 jobs were lost. But the Trump administration has said the reason for that is because that rollback in regulations that you mentioned. There are others, though, that say that the reason the coal production is up is that there is a demand in other countries, especially China. So what's the truth? What's going on?
Yeah, I think the latter is probably more true than the former. And, you know, there was a coal mine production started going up at the very tail end of the Obama administration, if you look at month-to-month figures. And I think what coal industry analysts will tell you is that there were, exports have really helped, you know, save the coal industry. It accounted for, you know, a much larger
portion. It's accounting for, you know, a greater portion of domestic production today than it did a few years ago. And also, there was sort of like a, you know, after an industry hits rock bottom, it's going to bounce up a little bit. And so that's kind of what we saw in 2017. Now, as a long-term trend, the folks I've talked to who are sort of industry analyst types don't, you know, they see it sort of wobbling at its current level. You know, it might go up a little bit, it might go down a little bit. But the big leviathan out there for coal is all these natural gas-fired power plants that are going to start getting built. And, you know, they're basically coming for that market.
Yeah, that war on coal that President Trump talks about, you know, there are many people say, well, there never was a war on coal. What actually has happened is that natural gas has replaced coal as far as a fuel for power plants, right?
Yeah. So the war on coal, which we've all heard a lot about, there was a study that Columbia University researchers did, and they found that about 3 to 5% of the drop-off in coal in the last few years was due to regulations. A full 50% was natural gas, and there were, you know, the rest were other factors. But, you know, there's no question that the big issue for coal is that it's having a hard time competing with natural gas for price and increasingly renewable energy.
When you say increasing renewable energy, we really haven't heard that, you know, in the southwestern Pennsylvania or the places where coal is produced. What's going on there?
Well, maybe not in, you know, around Pittsburgh. You know, there are not a lot of new wind farms. But around the country, you know, wind and solar in different parts of the country are getting cheaper and cheaper, and they're getting more competitive with, you know, more traditional fuel sources. So, you know, you're seeing, you know, renewable energy is still in the single digits as a percentage of our total electricity in the United States. But, you know, if you look at, you know, the fastest growing fuel sources are typically year to year, you know, wind and solar and you know, and natural gas. Although natural gas is, you know, it's now our greatest source of electricity. Coal used to be about half of our electricity, and now it's around 30%, and natural gas is just ahead of it at this point.
We have an email here from Tom in Carlisle, who says a big distinction must be made between the Four West mine and the two coal mines that recently opened in western Pennsylvania. Four West is mining steam-grade coal suitable for generating electricity. The two new mines are mining metallurgical grade coal used in steel production. Metallurgical coal sells for four times the price of steam coal and is far too valuable to burn for power generation. A big difference. Is that right?
That's absolutely right. You have some really well-informed emailers on your show, Scott. That's very good. And that was a point I forgot to mention in this sort of bounce back of coal production, especially in Pennsylvania, is that Pennsylvania happens to have you know, some of the best metallurgical coal in North America just because of our geology here. And you know, what Tom said is true. Metallurgical coal is sort of like, think of it as high-grade coal, like top-of-the-shelf stuff. You wouldn't, you know, you wouldn't pour olive oil into your car to run it. You would use it to cook spaghetti. But you need way more gasoline because you just use a lot of gasoline. So it's used in steel making, and for various reasons, there's been an increased demand for metallurgical coal around the world. Some of those reasons include, you know, there was a cyclone in Australia, and Australia is a big exporter of metallurgical coal. So all these factors that are way beyond anybody's control, you know, typically, you know, kind of influence what happens in our economy locally.
Mm. Well, if you'd like to read Reed Frazier's story about the Four West mine closing and the coal industry, plus a lot of other stories about Pennsylvania's energy economy, go to WITF.org and you can click on State Impact. Hey, Reed Frazier, thank you very much for being with us today.
Thank you.
Reed Frazier is with the Allegheny Front, part of State Impact Pennsylvania, that reports on Pennsylvania's energy economy. State Impact Pennsylvania is a collaboration among WITF, WHYY, WESA, and the Allegheny Front to cover the Commonwealth's energy economy. To learn more, visit WITF.org and click on State Impact Pennsylvania. Coming up on tomorrow's show, another attempt at property tax reform. Yet we know we've heard a lot about it over the last few years, but a few changes, few tweaks here and there, and we'll talk with one of the sponsoring senators on tomorrow's show.